from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Stephen Greenhouse knows labor. For 19 years, he worked as the labor and workplace reporter for the New York Times. And in his new book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, Greenhouse guides us through the important moments of the U.S. labor movement, from Francis Perkins and the New Deal to the fight for 15 in more recent years. Greenhouse argues that as we examine that history of American labor unions, we can track a rise and then a decline in worker power. That decline's led to imbalances across American life, Greenhouse says, to income inequality, personal well-being, and stability. But Greenhouse also sees corners of the economy where workers are trying to right that balance. So this hour on Point, Stephen Greenhouse on the past, present, and future of American labor. And you can join us. Are you a member of a labor union, or were your parents? In the fight for 15, for example, or the wave of teacher strikes that we've recently seen, are unions on the rise? Or do you see reason for concern in those very same modern movements? Send us a comment on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, Stephen Greenhouse joins us today from New York. His new book, as I said, is called Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. And we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Meghna.
It's great to have you. So first of all, I just want to ask you to start where the very introduction of your own book starts, with one of your personal experiences with the influence of unions in your own newsroom back in the 1970s. Could you share that story with us?
So I was in my mid-20s. I had been working at a newspaper in northern New Jersey, and I was making about $220, $240 a week. And we were working 60, 70 hours a week. We'd report into work around after lunch, around 1 o'clock. We'd work on stories during the afternoon. Then we'd at night, we'd cover school board meetings and town council meetings. And we'd often work till 1 or 2 in the morning. And we just thought we were being hugely underpaid. So we, about 20 of us got together and said, we could probably raise our pay if we form a union. And we scheduled a meeting at a local restaurant for Friday night. And we come back from lunch that Friday afternoon, and lo and behold, there's a surprise message on the newsroom bulletin board. Everyone's getting a 20% raise. And we said, hooray, hooray, hooray. Just fighting for a union, calling for a union, scared management so much that they gave this huge raise. So we were happy about that. The momentum for the union died out, but it shows how worried, this was back in the 1970s, how worried our boss, our manager and many companies were about unionization. It's much harder to unionize nowadays.
Right. Well, and also just out of full disclosure, newsrooms are amongst the places in the U.S. economy right now that are being unionized perhaps more than others. And full disclosure, including the WBUR newsroom here. But Stephen, let me just ask you, over your 19 years, and you've been following labor for longer than that, but just even over the period of time that you were covering it for the New York Times, what change did you see in the power of unions?
So I saw two big trends, and I kind of wrote books about each one. One was in the beginning of this century, the first decade, corporate profits, the stock market, employee productivity was going to record levels year after year. And wages were flat, even going down, and benefits companies were slashing benefits. And I wrote a book called The Big Squeeze about that. Now, I'm realizing that, why was all this happening? Largely because worker power, the ability of workers to demand adequate wages, to keep up with inflation, to demand that there not be cuts in their health benefits, to demand that they keep their pensions. Worker power in the United States has really declined, I argue, to its lowest level since the Great Depression. And one big reason for that is that the percentage of workers in unions has declined very sharply from around 35% at its peak in the 1950s to about 10% today. And I believe that that decline in worker power has had many, many bad ramifications for the United States. I think that's one reason there are so many low-wage jobs. Low-wage workers have a harder time, demanding higher pay. I think that's another reason for the decades of wage stagnation that we all talk about and that Donald Trump really milked to help win election in 2016. I think another outcome of the reduced worker power is that income inequality is at its highest level since the 1920s, since the Gilded Age. And the last problem I see from this decline in worker power is our political system is really skewed in favor of corporations and the very wealthy. For instance, in campaign donations in the 2016 election cycle, corporations gave $3.4 billion, which was 16 times as much as unions, which gave about $215 million. So, worker power is just swamped by corporate power. And that's why, even though 75%, 80%, 85% of Americans support a higher minimum wage or support a law that would guarantee paid sick days to all workers or would guarantee paid maternity and paid parental leave, we're the only industrialized nation in the world that doesn't, that doesn't guarantee paid maternity and parental leave. These ideas really don't have a snowball's chance of hell in getting through Congress because so many lawmakers are much more responsive to corporations than to worker interests. Mm-hmm.
Well, so you just there's a lot that you said that I want to dig into in more detail. Plus, your book is full of very interesting labor history, actually, which I think, since we're more than a century out from a lot of the stories you tell, aren't as well known as they were before. So we'll get to that in a second. But Stephen, I just wanted to dig in on one set of numbers with you a little bit more. As you said, the percentage of workers who belong to a labor union in the United States peaked at roughly 35% in the 1950s. And then just echoing what you said, today it's roughly 10%. So we've seen this decades-long decline. You talked about the consequences of that decline as you see it. But what caused it? Like, why did we start seeing a reduction in the number of people who were in unions?
Good question. I could answer that for 3 hours, but I'll try to keep it much shorter. There are many reasons. One was, historically, the core of labor was manufacturing. And, unions were strongest in the 1950s and 1960s. And really in the 1980s, we, the United States, felt a huge influx of foreign goods, of steel, of cars. And that combined with this horrible recession in 1980, 1981, really clobbered manufacturing in the U.S. And we declined from around 19 million manufacturing jobs to 12 million. And that really zapped unions very, very much. Another big change in the 1950s, 1960s, corporations in the U.S. kind of worked hand in hand with unions. Throughout World War II, it was really fascinating how business and labor formed this wonderful partnership that we're going to work together to beat the Nazis. And I think that goodwill and kind of cooperation lasted into the 50s and 60s. In the 1970s, the U.S. economy hit some big strains with the oil shocks of 73 and 79. And then 1980, Ronald Reagan faced this illegal strike from the air traffic controllers, and he fired 11,300. And that kind of sent a message to corporate America: hey, folks, it's really time. It's really okay to get tougher with workers, with your unions. And I argue that a big reason that the unionization rate has fallen so much is that corporations have gotten much tougher on unions. Now, lastly, I think unions have shot themselves in the foot in many ways. There was far too much corruption in unions, famously in the 1950s, with the Teamsters, with the longshoremen. I'm sure many listeners saw on the waterfront. And fortunately, unions are much less corrupt than they were. And I often have arguments with people about whether unions are any more corrupt than politicians or businesses. They're all way too corrupt. But I think unions are way, way, way lower than in decades past. And unions discriminated too much against women in decades past, discriminated too much against African American workers, Asian workers, Hispanic workers. But that's gotten much better. And indeed, unions try very hard now to unionize immigrant workers, seeing that they are a real future population that's interested in unionizing.
Well, since you mentioned Ronald Reagan and the air traffic controllers strike here, I just want to actually play a moment from that. This is in 1981 when, almost 13,000 members of the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization declared a strike for better pay and working conditions. And President Reagan, in a speech, said that the workers were actually breaking federal law, a law that that forbids government employees from striking.
It is for this reason that I must tell those who fail to report for duty this morning, they are in violation of the law And if they do not report for work within 48 hours, they have forfeited their jobs and will be terminated.
And indeed, 2 days later, the president fired 11,000 striking union workers, again saying that they were required by law to report to work and there was an issue of public safety. You know, Stephen, I went back and looked at that whole speech that President Reagan gave, and it was interesting because he notes at the beginning that he may be the only president or the first president who was also a lifetime member of the AFL-CIO, given his...
And he led a strike by the Screen Actors Guild, too.
In Hollywood, exactly.
Yes.
But was what Ronald Reagan did sort of the most public or high-profile turning point in terms of federal policy or the federal approach to unions?
I would say yes, Magna. You know, I have chapters in the book about, you know, the greatest success, greatest win of unions in the 20th century was the great Flint sit-down strike, which, you know, where 2,000 workers, sat down in the middle of winter for 6, 7, 8 weeks in Flint, Michigan, and that succeeded in unionizing the world's biggest, most powerful corporation, General Motors. And I have a chapter about the PATCA strike, the air traffic controller strike, which was the most disastrous episode for labor in the 20th century. And President Reagan, you know, confronted what was an illegal strike. Air traffic controllers were federal employees who are prohibited from going on strike. Air traffic controllers take a pledge the day they begin work that they're not going to go on strike. So he really cracked down. I think he wanted to send a message. He was in his early months as president. He wanted to send a message to Russia, to the world, that I can't be pushed around. And as I said, and that really sent a message to corporate executives around the country that, hey, maybe it's not such a bad idea to get tough on unions. Mm.
Well, we are talking this hour with Stephen Greenhouse. He was the longtime labor reporter for The New York Times, and he's out with a new book called Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. And we want to hear from you. What's your view on unions today in 2019? Are they a way for workers to regain some power in the workplace, or do workers go to unions when we have a failure more broadly of public policy? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Stephen Greenhouse. He was the longtime labor reporter for The New York Times, was in that job for 19 years, was with The Times for 31 years, and he's got this interesting new book out called Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. And we want to hear from you. Are you an American worker who's looking towards collective action or unionization of some kind as a way to correct the decade-long wage stagnation we've been seeing, even as productivity has risen in the United States? Or do you see unions as a force for making the American economy uncompetitive or calcified? Does being in a union prevent you from acting in your own best interests as a worker? Now, Stephen, I think one of the most interesting parts of your book is helping us march back in history a little bit and hear some of the early stories about the American labor movement. So could you tell us the story, for those who don't know it, of Clara Lemlich?
So I decided, why did I write this book? One of the reasons was I thought too many Americans, especially young Americans, know very little about the history of labor, know very little about what unions have done. You know, a lot of young Americans take things for granted. They take the 40-hour week for granted. They take employer-sponsored health care for granted. So I thought, let me write this history. But I didn't write a comprehensive history. I wrote a history that, really was key episodes. And I've always been fascinated by this woman, Clara Lemlich. Now, why? So she was an immigrant from the Ukraine. She was Jewish. There were horrible pogroms near where she lived in the Ukraine, and her family fled like 2 million other Jews. And, she had wanted to become a doctor. Her family moved to the Lower East Side in Manhattan. She didn't speak English. She didn't have a high school degree. It was very hard for her to ever study to become a doctor. So what did she do? You know, she worked in the garment trade, and she was really shocked at how bad the conditions were. You know, she complained that, you know, we worked from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. You know, many days we never saw the sun. They had to pay for the needle and thread. You know, the bosses, as too often happens today, would sexually harass, would grab the women. When women were in the, you know, bathroom for more than a minute or two, the people would be knocking on the door, you know, get out of there. They were paid just, you know, a few dollars a week. Sometimes they had to pay to rent their chairs. Sometimes they had to pay for the drinking water. And the women got very, very frustrated and upset. And there was a debate to whether to go on strike. And there was this magical historical moment where 2,000, 3,000 garment workers, probably 90, 95% of them women, many of them were teenagers, were in the Great Hall of Cooper Union in Greenwich Village. That's where Abraham Lincoln gave the speech that really catapulted him to fame. So these people were debating. Samuel Gompers, the founder of the AFL, was there. They were debating, should there be a strike? And there was a lot of temporizing. And suddenly this small, 5-foot-tall woman in her early 20s stands up and yells in Yiddish, "I want to say something." And she's literally lifted onto the stage and she says, "I'm tired of all this talk. I call that we hold a general strike." And there was pandemonium. People went crazy. And the next day, there was the biggest strike in the history, you know, ever undertaken by American women, like 20,000. It was called the Uprising of the 20,000. And some say it was even 30 or 40,000 women. And this was in November. And, you know, these, you know, women went on strike for about 8 weeks in the middle of winter. They had very little money, very little food, you know, very little money for food. Clara Lemlich was one of the leaders. She ran from picket line to picket line to picket line. And finally, the workers didn't win the strike. What did they win? They won a 52-hour week. I said before, too many workers take the 40-hour week for granted. You know, women had to fight and sacrifice and struggle just to win a 52-hour week before it finally came down to 40 hours. Another thing they won was they no longer had to pay for needle and thread.
Wow. Well, there are many other stories in your book like that, and we'll hear them. But let's just take a call here while we can. George is calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. George, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? As a union employee, I work for UPS, so I'm part of Teamsters, National Brotherhood. My question is what is your opinion on the fact that non-union employees, corporate companies look down upon unionized employees such as myself and categorize us as self-entitled and useless employees as a driver myself for UPS. I know my job is very difficult and very demanding some days, especially towards the holiday season.
Mm-hmm. Well, George, thank you for your call. Stephen, would you like to give him an answer?
George, good question. When you say looked down upon by non-union employees, my guess is you're talking about managers, not non-union workers working at McDonald's who wish that they were in a union and were paid as well as a UPS driver like you and had the benefits of you as a UPS driver. So one of the points I make in my book, and it's really kind of caught on, is I say, you know, in no other industrial nation do corporations fight so hard to beat back to quash unions. And I think in the United States, there really is this management mentality to always put down unions. And I was a reporter in Paris, the European economic correspondent for the New York Times for 5 years. And I saw in Germany and Spain and Denmark and Italy and Sweden, in Austria, that management worked hand in hand with companies, with unions, that they saw that unions are legitimate institutions that are trying to improve the lot of workers. And there was a partnership. I find in the United States, far too often, employers see unions as, you know, a horrible enemy to be crushed, to be annihilated. And part of that, George, is that they're always putting down union folks as entitled, as earning too much. And, you know, if there weren't unions, I believe a lot of workers would be earning a lot less. Now, there are some, you know, sometimes union members, you know, don't work hard enough. Sometimes non-union workers don't work hard enough. And you know, I think it's important that, you know, people put in a good day, you know, people put in a good day's work for a good day's pay.
Well, so, Stephen, let me let me draw out the focus here for a second from the level of individual workers to the effects that businesses say that unions have had on their ability to do business more broadly. For example, you know, there are, you know them better than I do, the industries out there who have made arguments that the union contracts that they've come to agree upon might have worked at that time, but in the future it made it very difficult to do business because economic factors have changed. Or how about at the level of public sector unions? You know, there have been a rash of stories over many years of states simply not having the money available to pay for the promised, you know, lifetime retirement benefits, for example, that were negotiated 10, 20, 30 years ago with their public sector unions. And so businesses or even governments feel very locked in to agreements that make it difficult for them to do as well as possible for all their workers or all the residents of their state. What do you think about that argument?
So a few responses. First, you know, American, you know, corporate executives often say we can't be competitive when we have a union. So you look at Germany, which has probably the most powerful union movement in the world, and you look at Mercedes-Benz and Daimler and Siemens. A lot of corporations in Germany do very, very well even with a union. Second, you often hear corporate executives say, oh, it's unions that caused all these companies to set up factories overseas. I was just in Virginia this past weekend giving speeches, and basically the whole furniture industry of Virginia has left for China, and that was basically all non-union. So it's wrong to say, oh, unions caused all these companies to move operations overseas. You know, it was desire to maximize profits that did that, and whether you were union or non-union. And third, to your point about public sector unions. You know, public sector unions try to ensure that, you know, public sector workers have adequate pay. There has been, I agree, a problem with some pensions, that some of the pensions have been too generous. I think some politicians were short-sighted. They didn't want to give near-term raises because that might force them to, you know, raise taxes sooner or force them to have a budget deficit. Mm-hmm. So they made these elaborate promises on pensions that they didn't fully understand. And the some pensions, you know, are quite high, and a lot, you know, one of the reasons for the pension crisis in states like Illinois is many governors did not pay in the amount they're supposed to pay each year towards the pensions. And, you know, my father was a public school teacher on Long Island. And it used to be public school teachers did not make a decent living, and they really struggled, and they had second jobs and third jobs, and that was very much the case recently in West Virginia and Arizona and Oklahoma, helping cause the strikes. But my father finally, you know, had a good middle class life. He was, you know, not rich by any means, you know, thanks to the union. And my father was an outspoken opponent of the Vietnam War. And I'm quite sure that in the conservative school district where he taught, he would have been fired, you know, immediately because he was so outspoken. And union protections really help, you know, really for public employees, really help ensure that workers can speak workers can speak their mind.
You know, your example about the unions in the German auto industry, it makes me wonder. I sort of asked this question of listeners. I want to ask it directly to you, Stephen. I mean, is it really a good comparison? Because can't one make the argument that part of the driving force behind America's sort of fraught relationship with unions has to do with the fact that unions have in this nation have been forced to step in when there have been failures of broader public policy? Like, they are fighting for basic things such as health care or living wages, et cetera, which perhaps the state more broadly in other countries has fashioned better public policy around.
That's a great point, Meghna. So, you know, again, I was a reporter in Europe for 5 years, and people in Europe would make fun of the McJobs in the United States, that there were a gazillion workers working at minimum wage, and you know, whether it was, you know, $4.25 or $5.25, and now it's $7.25 an hour. You know, good luck in trying to, you know, live on $7.25 an hour. And in my book, I say, you know, there are all these, you know, $10 million a year corporate executives, all these $300,000 a year folks at conservative think tanks saying it's a horrible idea to raise the minimum wage. I think they should live a month or two on $7.25 an hour and see what it's like. And the reason for the fight for 15, the reason, you know, unions try to you know, better Social Security for folks and better Medicaid and Medicare for folks, is they see that, you know, the United States has a far, far worse social safety net than other industrial nations. Our minimum wage as a percentage of the average wage is the lowest of any industrialized country in the world. And it's unions that really play a vital role in trying to create a fairer, more democratic nation. I was the first reporter to cover the fight for 15 here in New York. And I remember the very first day they went on strike, November 29th, 2012. It was about 250 workers at maybe 20 McDonald's. And I thought, oh, this is a nice little thing. It's not going to go anywhere. I remember the organizing director of the Fight for 15, Kendall Fells, telling me, we're going to get $15. And I said, Kendall, that's insane. You know, that's pie in the sky. And so here we are 7 years later, not even 7 years later, you know, seven states, Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Maryland, Illinois, California, I probably added one too many states there, have enacted a $15 minimum wage. Some 22 million workers have had their wages lifted thanks to the Fight for 15 and the upward momentum it's brought for wages. And I remember here in New York when Governor Cuomo signed on to the idea of a $15 minimum wage, Kendall Fells called me like 2 minutes later and said, see, Greenhouse, you were wrong. We were right.
Well, I actually want to just play a clip from 2015 the quote-unquote Fight for 15. And as Stephen just said, that was the movement to push the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Here's KFC employee Daryl Odom testifying to the Atlanta Wage Board about why he believes workers like him needed a raise.
This is my passion. I love to cook for KFC. I don't want my son to look at me like I'm something less. Because I have to work for $7.25 when I bust my butt every day and I take pride in what I do, gentlemen. We have a voice and we want it to be heard. We want 15.
Well, that was from a 2015 bit of testimony from a KFC employee in Atlanta. Let's go to Sam, who's calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Sam, you're on the air.
Hi. Hey, I just don't see the justification for $15 an hour. I mean, my whole content is, when I just got out of high school, I made $2.13 an hour. That was minimum wage. By no means did I expect to raise a family on that. When I was younger, my father always told me, you either prepare to succeed or you prepare to fail. Now, my point is that you shouldn't be trying to raise a family on minimum wage. If you are, you went astray in your planning. As you get job skills and education, you won't be making minimum wage. So the takeaway is, if you're 18 right out of high school, or if you're 20 or 30, if you don't have the job skills that demand higher wages, you're not going to get them. The bottom rung on an economic ladder will always be the bottom rung. If you raise wages, the minimum to $15 an hour, that's going to push up the cost of objects that much more. You're still going to be on the bottom rung. If you look at the Boy Scouts, if you work hard, you end up an Eagle Scout. Yeah. If you look at the military, if you work hard, you end up with stripes or whatever. If you don't, you're private. So I'm not degrading people who are working for minimum wage. I think the effort should be on increasing job skill and increasing education.
Yeah, well, Sam, thank you so much for your call. Stephen Greenhouse, want to reply to Sam?
Sam, you're certainly correct that people on the bottom will be on the bottom. And you're certainly correct that, you know, everyone should try to better themselves through education to raise their pay. However, you know, if the hundreds of thousands of people who work at McDonald's or the hundreds of thousands of people who work as home care aides all went to college and were able to find better jobs, we would still need hundreds of thousands of people to work at McDonald's to serve as home care aides for my parents or your parents. And, you know, and I think people make a good argument that the floor in the United States is too low. There are a lot of people who can't afford college, who would love to go to college, but they have two or three kids and they need to continue working. So the question is, do we continue to let all these workers, you know, work at toil at $7.25 an hour, $8.25 an hour, struggling to make ends meet, having the federal government subsidize the McDonald's and the Walmarts and the Amazons by, you know, with food stamps and Medicaid? I want to tell a quick story. So I was on a wonderful radio show called On Point a few years ago discussing the Fight for 15. And there was this worker, Terrence Wise from Kansas City, and he was incredibly eloquent. And he said he held two jobs, his wife was a home care aide, yet they were homeless. And it was crazy that, you know, here's someone doing the right thing, you know, busting his butt. You know, and I write about Terrence in my book. He would leave his house in the morning at 6:37 to go to his, you know, his Burger King job. And before his three daughters got up, and then at 3 p.m., he'd go to his Pizza Hut job, and he'd get home at midnight, 1 a.m. each night, and he wouldn't see his daughters. And I wrote about him, and, you know, it shows how even people who work very hard, and this is a very bright guy who wanted to go to college, but he had some bad breaks, and he really, you know, said, we need $15 for me to do a decent job supporting my family.
Mm. Well, Stephen Greenhouse, stand by for just a moment. We are talking with Stephen this hour about his new book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Stephen Greenhouse. He was the longtime labor reporter for the New York Times. He's author of a new book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. We have an excerpt of it, by the way, at onpointradio.org, and we want to hear your questions. Let's go to Daniel, who's calling from West Palm Beach, Florida. Daniel, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. You know, I was a lifelong union member, at least the 17 years I worked in a union shop for the telephone company. I'm in Florida, where we're a right-to-work state, or as union members call it, a right-to-work-for-less state. But that means that no one can be forced to join the union or pay union dues, even though they enjoy union benefits and wages. I always was a union member and gladly paid my dues, because I could never honestly look at my paycheck and say there would be more in it if there was no union and no dues. I was raised by a father who was a lifetime union carpenter, you know, and I've studied the history of labor. I know the abuses, and I admire great companies. If a company really wants to get rid of unions, pay and treat your employees so well that they don't care to have a union.
Right. Well, Daniel, thank you so much for your call. Stephen, Daniel's call and sort of the multi-generational impact that unions have had on his life makes me want to actually look forward to future generations here, which you do in your book, because as the global economy and definitely the U.S. economy is changing, what role do you see unions as having, or sort of the basic model that we have of unions, very much a 20th century model that may not fit workers' needs now?
So, Meghna, I profile a fifth-generation auto worker, fifth-generation UAW auto worker, a woman named Jennifer Sanders in Flint, Michigan. And she, you know, says, you know, thanks to the union, thanks to the Flint sit-down strike, which her great-grandfather was involved in, you know, we have all these wonderful things. We have, you know, good wages and good health coverage and good pensions. And, you know, she worries that the union has grown weaker. And I quote her saying, I worry that there'll be a world without a union. I worry what it will mean for my daughter and my nieces, that if there's a world without a union, what will that mean for wages? What will that mean for labor standards? So I remember a professor told me a few years ago, if unions didn't exist, someone would go out and invent them. And unions have become much weaker in the United States, but I think partly because they've gotten so weak and wages and conditions have gotten so bad for many workers, we're seeing this pushback. We have all these well-educated people in digital media working for radio stations, and they feel, you know, the pay at 30, 35, 40,000 ain't going to cut it in cities like New York or Boston or San Francisco. And we've seen a big unionization movement there. We've seen, you know, well-educated people who become adjunct professors. They're getting paid $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a course. Maybe they can put together 5 or 6 courses a year. They're making $25,000 or $30,000. They say, this is terrible. What's the way we could raise our station in life? And it's to, you know, to come together and unionize. And I believe, you know, the teacher strikes last year were in states where, you know, bright red states where unions are very weak. And the teachers felt they've been stepped on, beaten down, you know, for year after year. I interviewed this one teacher, in, you know, just outside Phoenix. She said she hadn't gotten a pay raise in 10 years. I interviewed another teacher in Arizona, one of the leaders of the strike, 23-year-old guy. Who said, I was making just $32,000, $33,000 a year, and it's hard to live on that. And the teachers in especially these three states, West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, were fed up that year after year, state education budgets were flat, teacher salaries weren't going anywhere, while they saw the legislature rushing to give tax cuts to the wealthy, to oil companies, to fracking companies. And they said, something is seriously broken here. And you know, the Koch brothers network, you know, had a lot of power, you know, helping elect these people and deciding what would be legislated. And the teachers said, something is rotten here. We have to exercise a collective power. And what's fascinating is, you know, it began in West Virginia. Why in West Virginia? I think a big reason was it had this history of the coal miners, of the mine workers union, of labor militancy. And I interviewed teachers in West Virginia and said, why did I do this? Because I was inspired by my grandpa. He taught us to stand up when things are bad, and we're standing up now.
Well, but at the same time, though, we've seen the teachers are the best example of public sector unions, even in some of those states where I don't think they had the right to collectively bargain. I'm just trying to fact check which state that was. I think it might have been West Virginia.
Most of them. You're correct.
Yes.
Most of them.
Yes. So that's one thing. And we'll come back to the public sector in a second here. But I'm thinking also more broadly about, you know, there's always this discussion about where the gig economy is headed. And so many millions of people touch the gig economy, or their entire livelihoods are being made through the gig economy. And this is a way of being, a way of doing business, a way of earning money that is pretty much as polar opposite. It's the polar opposite of collectivism. So how does the union model fit into, you know, these companies that are leading this edge of the economy?
Magna, I call that the $64 trillion question.
Yeah.
It's really hard because, you know, if these, you know, newfangled gig workers are considered independent contractors, under federal law, independent contractors cannot unionize. They're all considered independent businessmen. And if they unionize, it's considered a conspiracy and restraint of trade. However, if they're defined as employees instead, under federal law, employees have a right to unionize. That's why a lot of Uber drivers are saying, and Lyft drivers are saying, we want to be considered employees because then we can unionize.
And those companies are very, very strongly resisting that.
Extremely. Yeah. I read about an Uber driver in Seattle who joined a news conference calling for higher pay and a union. And like 3 hours later, he was fired. And they said his insurance had expired. And he, you know, emailed all these newspaper reporters, you know, with pictures of his insurance card showing that it's still, you know, in force. And then Uber had to eat crow and rehire him the next day. But, you know, so all these Uber drivers would like to unionize because, you know, some of them complain that they just make $5 an hour, $7 an hour, that they work 60 hours a week. And, you know, the Trump administration has said that Uber drivers and Lyft drivers should be considered independent contractors and therefore not have the right to unionize. So here in New York, something really fascinating happened. The Taxi and Limousine Commission, seeing that 90%, 95% of app-based drivers are making less than the minimum wage, it issued a ruling that, you know, all Uber and Lyft drivers should be making a minimum pay of $17.22 an hour after expenses. And the Taxi and Limousine Commission did that after being pushed by these worker organizations made up of Uber and Lyft drivers. They're not formal unions that engage in formal bargaining, but, you know, they're smart folks who who band together to try to pressure to improve their lot. And that's what happened with the Taxi and Limousine Commission. And guess what? Uber drivers in Los Angeles and Seattle and other cities say, we want our city governments to do exactly what the New York City Taxi and Limousine Commission did.
But just to be clear, that's not the same thing as being a formal union, right?
And having, right.
And being recognized by the NLRB and all the sort of state and federal rules that are involved with that.
Absolutely right, Magda. As I said, whether you're a TaskRabbit worker or a Mechanical Turk worker, or you're generally considered an independent contractor, and they can't unionize, under the National Labor Relations Act. So all these gig workers are like struggling to find some tools, weapons, strategies to get more collective power. We saw this scandal with DoorDash recently, where the DoorDash workers saw that the company was basically stealing their tips and pocketing them, and they started a petition. And sometimes, okay, you can't form a union, but maybe with a petition and going to newspaper reporters, you make a big stink about when you're being cheated, and that will get results. I profile a Mechanical Turk worker who says sometimes she just makes, $5, $6, $7, $8 an hour, and they, are trying to figure out ways to pressure Mechanical Turk's owner, Amazon, to pay them better, to make sure that, employers don't cheat them. A lot of time, employers don't pay them for the work they do for Mechanical Turk. So, gig workers are really trying to figure out what to do. Here in New York, there's something called the Freelancers Union that's become a nationwide organization for freelance writers, freelance artists, freelance web designers. And they got this, and one of the big problems for freelancers was they do work, they'd spend a month or two, and they wouldn't be paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
So they got the New York City Council to pass a law called, Freelancing Isn't Free Law that, would double or triple the penalty on companies, on folks who use freelancers and don't pay them. So there are these incipient, inchoate, efforts to, for gig workers to rally together to figure out how to raise their pay.
Yeah. So I want to
and improve their lives. Sorry.
I want to circle back. This is a great way to circle back to sort of where we started and one of the maybe the core idea of your book, right? Which is that long-term shift of power from the tilting of the balance of power towards management or corporations. Because when you think about it, in a lot of industries, essentially on one side of the table, there's monopoly power. And I don't mean monopoly in terms of like one company, but the management and the corporation are one entity, and then you have workers on the other side. And historically, the formation of a union is the way to balance that power out. But you also say in the book that it's hard to say what form a future workers' movement should or will take, because to succeed, as you write, we've seen often it takes two seemingly contradictory things, individual agency and group solidarity. So how does that work in the 21st century?
So I write about a group in Florida called the Coalition of Mockley Workers, a wonderful group that has done amazing things lifting wages and standards for 35,000 farm workers in tomato pickers in Florida. They had been some of them had been basically enslaved. There was horrible, horrible sexual harassment, sexual abuse of the workers. They were desperate to get a job, and the crew leaders would say, if you want to work for me, you got to give out. So that was founded by one or two Hispanic farm workers, a few Haitian farm workers, and two idealistic Brown University graduates. They got together and launched a movement. And now, 20 years later, they're one of the most successful non-union worker advocates in the country. And you look at I have a chapter on the great Walter Reuther, who played a crucial role in founding the United Auto Workers and building the United Auto Workers and negotiating these extraordinary contracts in the 1950s that probably more than anything else helped build the nation's middle class. And it kind of takes the leadership of some individuals and they need a message. They need to be able to persuade people. Then it takes, a lot of people joining them. And we've seen that with Uber drivers. There are some Uber driver groups, and there are two or three Uber drivers who are courageous and stick their neck out, and they get other Uber drivers to join them. And so whether it's Mechanical Turk workers or DoorDash people, Workers, if they're going to move forward, they need some leaders who are going to stick their necks out, and they need other people to join them. Mm-hmm. I want to draw a quick contrast. So one of my favorite Americans is this native-born woman from Massachusetts, Frances Perkins, who was the first female cabinet secretary. She was FDR's Secretary of Labor. And she went to Mount Holyoke, and her parents wanted her to be a teacher. And she was in Chicago teaching at a fancy children's school, and she was working at the Great Hull House and started working with all these poor children and poor workers. And she decided to dedicate herself to helping the poor and helping workers. And she would say, she saw that unions only represented 10-20% of workers. This is back around 1910, 1920. And she said, it's more important to have a law that will help everybody, like a high minimum wage law or workers' compensation law, than to do it through unions, because unions often just help 10 or 20%. So here we are with gig workers, Meghna, and many of them have jobs that don't come with health coverage, that don't come with unemployment insurance, that don't come with retirement plans, and that's why I think there's this big push now to kind of try to make, health coverage universal, Medicare for all. That would help a lot of gig workers to try to figure out how to improve Social Security, because so many people are retiring without enough Social Security to live on. So there's this big argument about whether to do it through unions or whether to do it through laws. And, one of the big obstacles in trying to do it through unions is that corporate America fights so hard against unionization. And, folks at MIT did this recent study showing that 50% of non-union, non-managerial workers would vote to have a union tomorrow if they could. But only, that's up from like 32% mm-hmm. 20 years ago. But only 6.4% of workers in the private sector, 1 in 16, is in a union. So that means that lots more workers want to be in a union, but basically corporate opposition is preventing them from doing it.
Do you know, I want to get one last call in here, just under the wire. Ed's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Ed, we've just got about, a minute left here to go. So what do you want to say?
I have two things. It's gotten kind of long-winded here today. The Employee Free Choice Act, the Workplace Democracy Act, has not been introduced in this Congress by any of the presidential candidates. Even symbolically, that's important for us to have that law in the hopper. We understand McConnell. And the second point is that didn't get into the book here that we're talking about today is the abominable labor union leadership. Richard Trumka-esque style leadership in 2019. I hope you have Richard Trumka on before Labor Day, but part of this is our problem, too. We allowed the Scott Walkers of the world to get power.
Well, Ed, thank you so much for your call. It's Ed calling from Wisconsin. Stephen Greenhouse, you want to respond to that?
Point. So this point I make in my book that far too few people recognize is, so Scott Walker and the Republicans, declared war on public sector unions to weaken them. And of the past decade, the number of union members in Wisconsin has dropped by 43%, by 166,000. How many votes did Hillary Clinton lose Wisconsin by? 22,000. And one could wonder if unions hadn't declined so much in Wisconsin, might Hillary have won in Wisconsin? And same story in Michigan and Pennsylvania.
Well, on that note, I'll say thank you to you, Stephen. Stephen Greenhouse, author of Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. We have an excerpt of it at our website, onpointradio.org. It was wonderful to talk with you, Stephen. Thank you so much.
Great to talk with you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.